Welcome to Now You Know. I'm Catherine Sussman. Today I'm speaking with Rob Laidlaw, animal advocate, author, and founder of the Canadian-based wildlife protection charity, ZooCheck. Rob, great to speak with you today, this time on the topic of framing, something that occurs at many, if not most, zoos and aquariums around the world today.
So what exactly is framing?
Framing is one of the design tricks used when animals are exhibited to make the animal look like it's in a more natural circumstance than it actually is. And the best way to think about it is like framing a picture, and that's exactly why it's called framing. So let's give an example for people that are listening. Let's say you had a zebra on a patch of earth. Well, that patch of earth, if it was just standing on its own, most people would look at that and say, well, that's not very good. You know, there's a zebra standing on a patch of earth. But if you put a nice green background behind the zebra, and that could be vegetation or it could be other kinds of features, but of course the zebra doesn't have any access to it. It's just a background. So if you put that there, and if you put a nice green zone of vegetation on either side of the exhibit, and if you put a nice little buffer of vegetation at the front where people are viewing, basically when people look at that zebra, they're seeing it enveloped in a green background, sides, and front. So it's, in essence, a frame. The animal is framed. And the way it works is that when people look at that, and most zoo visitors are just casual visitors, they're not, you know, examining every exhibit, and they're not particularly discerning, and they may not even know much about the animals they're looking at. They'll walk along from that kind of exhibit with a zebra to another exhibit to another exhibit, and they'll be left with the impression that you have that zebra and other animals in this beautiful green environment. It's really more of a psychological trick than anything else. So framing is a way of sanitizing the view for visitors that are looking at animals. And like I said, it's just one of many design tricks that are used to make things appear better than they actually are.
So framing essentially fools visitors into thinking a zoo is better than it is?
It can. You know, if you have a whole bunch of very poor exhibits that are, you know, framed very well, the design, you know, is such that the illusion that it's trying to create actually works, then yeah, it will actually fool people. And I've encountered this many, many times in many kinds of zoos where people walk through a zoo, and the Toronto Zoo is a good example, where they'll walk through and they'll have the impression that the zoo is this lush green park-like environment with lots of naturalistic space for the animals. But if you then walk them through and show them some of the design tricks that fooled them on their previous go around the zoo, their eyes are really open and they see things very differently. So it's something that, you know, not very many people think about or know about. But if you know what to look for, you can see not only framing, but a variety of other kinds of tactics and strategies that are used to sanitize the view and make it look better for visitors.
So could you lay out for me a little bit what a visitor can do to be able to make that distinction between a natural habitat or a naturalistic habitat versus framing that's going on?
Well, framing is just a way of displaying the animal. And you could actually frame with a natural habitat. You don't need to, but, you know, in theory you could. But I think what people have to look for first and foremost is the actual living space for the animal. And it's funny because many facilities that people think are very good, when I take people around and I say, stand there and look at what space the animal actually has access to, once they've gone through that exercise, and it only takes a few seconds, they're actually appalled at a lot of what they see, and they weren't appalled previously. So sometimes it's just, you know, prompting people to look a little bit closer at what's in front of them and doing a little bit of critical thinking. And that can be applied to other things as well. You can say, okay, that animal has vegetation all around it. Is that vegetation actually accessible to that animal? 9 times out of 10, particularly for big animals like gorillas and elephants and other animals like that that have this potential to be destructive to vegetation, it's not accessible to those animals. They would love to have it, you know, to be able to manipulate, to tear it up, to eat it, to play with it, but most times it's not. So people can look at what is actually available in terms of vegetation and other things around the enclosure, and they can look in the enclosure as well to see, you know, what is in there that would actually keep an animal occupied if it's in that particular living space for days, weeks, months, or years. A lot of it is really applying common sense. You don't need to be a field biologist. You don't need to be a zoologist or a veterinarian or have a PhD in ethology. You know, a lot of it is just common sense. And if you have questions and think things are, you know, perhaps not the way they really should be, a great way for people to, you know, determine whether their feeling is valid or not is just to do a tiny bit of research on some of the animals that they've looked at. And that will often expose just how bad conditions are in zoos, even those conditions where the design tricks have been used to make things look better.
And this just makes me think about aquariums in general. For example, the Ripley's Aquarium in Toronto, you walk in and actually it's even more basic than all of that, because if you really stop to think about it, the animals have no natural light, they have no natural seawater.
Yes, there's a whole range of variables that exist in natural environments, both aquatic and terrestrial, that can't be replicated. They cannot be provided in captive situations. Some of them relate to the animals themselves, their ability to move normally, the ability to behave normally, to have a proper social context. But certainly, you know, other environmental factors can't be duplicated either. So, you know, in an aquarium, it's impossible to have ocean currents, which influence animals' lives. Proper light cycles are almost never duplicated in terrestrial or aquatic environments because they're variable in nature and they change by day, by season, and animals react to them differently. Animals that move up and down the water column, you know, most aquarium tanks are very, very shallow. And, you know, you just can't replicate a living environment for a lot of these creatures. And I think, you know, you can see it if you know what to look for in aquariums. You know, a lot of them look natural, but just like their terrestrial counterpart exhibits in zoos, I think what you're seeing in many of these instances is more an illusion. It's a lot more reminiscent of a movie set or something like that, maybe an amusement park environment, than it is real nature.
So do you recommend that we all boycott zoos?
I think boycotts have to be used strategically because they quickly become tiresome and their effectiveness is diluted if too many people try to do it too often. And I think in the case of zoos, there's just far too many people going to them. I just couldn't see a boycott except in a very specific kind of circumstance being an effective strategy for changing things. I think the best thing that people can do is to apply that critical thinking, do a little research, and to speak out on behalf of animals, because that old saying that all it takes for evil to triumph is for good to do nothing is very true. And certainly here in Canada and elsewhere in other countries, there's just not enough people saying, this is wrong, I want something done about it. And they can say that to zoo management, they can say that to local municipal councils or agencies if they have any relevance to the thing they're complaining about. They can certainly speak to their elected representatives and other levels of government. You know, engaging on that level with all of the relevant players is extremely important. And it doesn't mean that you have to spend hours and hours and hours every week doing it. It could be a simple letter that you send that is then copied to all of those particular groups or parties. You know, it can be as little or as much as you want. I think the key to change in any field is for everybody, no matter what their status in life, to find their place on the continuum of activity and to always seek to improve. If everybody did that, things would be profoundly different than they are.
How can a person tell if the zoo that they're going to visit is reputable?
I think, again, and for me as someone who places the actual biological, behavioral, and social needs as the highest priority, so basically the animal's welfare and well-being as the highest priority, the metric to measure facilities is first and foremost, How do they house and care for their animals and provide for their needs? And if an animal's needs are not being met, and occasionally there are good reasons why they're not, you know, it may be a rescue situation or it may be something else where you're taking an animal from a bad circumstance to at least a better circumstance. But if there's not some mitigating factor in the treatment of the animals that lead to it, all of its needs not being met, I think you really have to look at that as the metric for determining whether facilities are reputable or not. I don't think you can use propaganda. You know, many people, when you ask what are the best zoos in the world, for instance, will list the ones that have the biggest PR departments. You know, that's not a way to do it. Membership in zoo associations is another way that some people try to gauge zoos, but that's not a good measure either, because some of the best facilities that have wildlife in captivity, both aquatic and terrestrial, have nothing to do with the associations that maintain these memberships. So I think, you know, you have to look at the animals. Are they in natural conditions? Do they have space to move? Do they have stimulation? Do they have an ability to engage in species-typical movements and behaviors in the environments in which they're forced to live? And are they able to use many, if not all, of the other adaptations that they have evolved with to live in particular kinds of environments? And if they can't, then I think probably the zoo or the facility, at least in my opinion, wouldn't qualify as reputable.
Is there one simple action a person could take? If you had to pick just one action to help, you know, with this problem of framing, is there any way to distill that down in a nutshell what that would be?
It's very difficult to say because there's a whole suite of actions that people can take. But what I would say is probably, you know, considered a cliche, but I would say the most effective action you can take is just not to give those facilities that are not at a standard that's acceptable your money. So don't go.
Okay. Well, Rob, thank you so much. That's great.